Chapter 2. The Invisible Wall. Elizabeth City is a quaint, mid-sized port town with a relatively intact historic core. Like most other early American settlements, it grew around the water, in this case around the banks of the Pasquotank River, whose name is an English corruption of an Algonquin word meaning where the current forks. The river flows down from Chesapeake Bay, through the swamps of the Virginia-North Carolina border, and empties into Albemarle Sound, alongside the Chowan, the Perquimon, and other rivers. Whenever I consider what other directions my life might have taken, I think of that watershed. No matter the particular course the water travels from its source, it still ultimately arrives at the same destination. My family has always been connected to the sea, my mother's side in particular. Her heritage is straight pilgrim. Her first ancestor on these shores was John Alden, the Mayflower's cooper, or barrel maker. He became the husband of a fellow passenger named Priscilla Mullins, who had the dubious distinction of being the only single woman of marriageable age on board, and so the only single woman of marriageable age in the whole first generation of the Plymouth colony. John and Priscilla's Thanksgiving time coupling almost never happened, however, due to the meddling of the commander of the Plymouth colony, Miles Standish. His love for Priscilla, and Priscilla's rejection of him and eventual marriage to John, became the basis of a literary work that was referenced throughout my youth, The Courtship of Miles Standish, by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, himself an Alden Mullins descendant. Nothing was heard in the room but the hurrying pen of the stripling, busily writing epistles important to go by the Mayflower, ready to sail on the morrow or next day at latest, God willing, homeward bound with the tidings of all that terrible winter, letters written by Alden and full of the name of Priscilla, full of the name and the fame of the Puritan maiden, Priscilla. John and Priscilla's daughter Elizabeth was the first pilgrim child born in New England. My mother, whose name is also Elizabeth, is her direct descendant. Because the lineage is almost exclusively through the women, though, the surnames changed with nearly every generation, with an Alden marrying a Pabody, marrying a Grinnell, marrying a Stevens, marrying a Jocelyn. These seafaring ancestors of mine sailed down the coast from what's now Massachusetts to Connecticut and New Jersey, plying trade routes and dodging pirates between the colonies and the Caribbean, until, with the Revolutionary War, the Jocelyn line settled in North Carolina. Amaziah Jocelyn, also spelled Amasiah Jocelyn, among other variants, was a privateer and a war hero. As captain of the 10-gun bark the Firebrand, he was credited with the defense of Cape Fear. Following American independence, he became the U.S. Navy agent, or supply officer, of the port of Wilmington, where he also established the city's first chamber of commerce, which he called, funnily enough, the Intelligence Office. The Jocelyns and their descendants, the Moores and the Halls and the Mylands and the Howells and Stevens and Restons and Stokelys, who comprised the rest of my mother's side, fought in every war in my country's history, from the Revolution and the Civil War, in which the Carolinian relatives fought for the Confederacy against their New England Union cousins, to both world wars. Mine is a family that has always answered the call of duty. My maternal grandfather, whom I call Pop, is better known as Rear Admiral Edward J. Barrett. At the time of my birth, he was Deputy Chief Aeronautical Engineering Division, Coast Guard Headquarters, Washington, D.C. He'd go on to hold various engineering and operational commands from Governor's Island, New York City, to Key West, Florida, where he was director of the Joint Interagency Task Force East, a multi-agency, multinational U.S. Coast Guard-led force dedicated to the interdiction of narcotics trafficking in the Caribbean. I wasn't aware of how high up the ranks Pop was rising, but I knew that the welcome-to-command ceremonies became more elaborate as time went on, with longer speeches and larger cakes. I remember the souvenir I was given by the artillery guard at one of them, the shell casing of a 40-millimeter round, still warm and smelling like powdered hell, which had just been fired in a salute in Pop's honor. Then there's my father, Lon, who, at the time of my birth, was a chief petty officer at the Coast Guard's Aviation Technical Training Center in Elizabeth City, working as a curriculum designer and electronics instructor. He was often away, leaving my mother at home to raise my sister and me. To give us a sense of responsibility, she gave us chores. To teach us how to read, she labeled all our dresser drawers with their contents, socks, underwear. She would load us into our Red Flyer wagon and tow us to the local library, where I immediately made for my favorite section, the one that I called Big Machines. Whenever my mother asked me if I was interested in any specific big machine, I was unstoppable. Dump trucks and steamrollers and forklifts and cranes and... Is that all, buddy? Oh, I'd say, and also cement mixers and bulldozers and... My mother loved giving me math challenges. At Kmart or Winn-Dixie, she'd have me pick out books and model cars and trucks and buy them for me if I was able to mentally add together their prices. Over the course of my childhood, she kept escalating the difficulty, first having me estimate and round to the nearest dollar, then having me figure out the precise dollar and cents amount, and then having me calculate 3% of that amount and add it on to the total. I was confused by that last challenge, not by the arithmetic so much as by the reasoning. Why? It's called tax, my mother explained. Everything we buy, we have to pay 3% to the government.
What do they do with it?
You like roads, buddy? You like bridges? She said. The government uses that money to fix them. They use that money to fill the library with books. Sometime later, I was afraid that my budding math skills had failed me when my mental totals didn't match those on the cash register's display. But once again, my mother explained. They raised the sales tax. Now you have to add 4%. So now the library will get even more books? I asked.
Let's hope, my mother said.
My grandmother lived a few streets over from us, across from the Carolina Feed and Seed Mill and a towering pecan tree. After stretching out my shirt to make a basket to fill with fallen pecans, I'd go up to her house and lie on the carpet beside the long, low bookshelves. My usual company was an edition of Aesop's Fables, and perhaps my favorite, Bullfinch's Mythology. I would leaf through the pages, pausing only to crack a few nuts while I absorbed accounts of flying horses, intricate labyrinths, and serpent-haired gorgons who turned mortals to stone. I was in awe of Odysseus, and liked Zeus, Apollo, Hermes, and Athena well enough, but the deity I admired most had to be Hephaestus, the ugly god of fire, volcanoes, blacksmiths, and carpenters, the god of tinkerers. I was proud of being able to spell his Greek name, and knowing that his Roman name, Vulcan, was used for the home planet of Spock from Star Trek. The fundamental premise of the Greco-Roman pantheon always stuck with me. Up at the summit of some mountain, there was this gang of gods and goddesses who spent most of their infinite existence fighting with each other and spying on the business of humanity. Occasionally, when they noticed something that intrigued or disturbed them, they disguised themselves as lambs and swans and lions and descended the slopes of Olympus to investigate and meddle. It was often a disaster. Someone always drowned or was struck by lightning or was turned into a tree whenever the immortals sought to impose their will and interfere in mortal affairs. Once, I picked up an illustrated version of the Legends of King Arthur and his Knights and found myself reading about another legendary mountain, this one in Wales. It served as the fortress of a tyrannical giant named Ritagaur, who refused to accept that the age of his reign had passed, and that, in the future, the world would be ruled by human kings, whom he considered tiny and weak. Determined to keep himself in power, he descended from his peak, attacking kingdom after kingdom and vanquishing their armies. Eventually, he managed to defeat and kill every single king of Wales and Scotland. Upon killing them, he shaved off their beards and wove them into a cloak, which he wore as a gory trophy. Then he decided to challenge the strongest king of Britain, King Arthur, giving him a choice. Arthur could either shave off his own beard and surrender, or Ritagaur would decapitate the king and remove the beard himself. Enraged at this hubris, Arthur set off for Ritagaur's mountain fortress. The king and the giant met on the highest peak and battled each other for days, until Arthur was gravely wounded. Just as Rita Gaur grabbed the king by the hair and prepared to cut off his head, Arthur summoned a last measure of strength and sank his fabled sword through the eye of the giant, who toppled over dead. Arthur and his knights then went about piling up a funeral cairn atop Rita Gaur's corpse, but before they could complete the work, snow began to fall. As they departed, the giant's blood-stained beard cloak was returned to perfect whiteness. The mountain was called Snawdon, which, a note explained, was Old English for snow mound. Today, Snawdon is called Mount Snowdon. A long extinct volcano, it is, at approximately 3,560 feet, the highest peak in Wales. I remember this feeling of encountering my name in this context. It was thrilling. And the archaic spelling gave me my first palpable sense that the world was older than I was, even older than my parents were. The name's association with the heroic exploits of Arthur and Lancelot and Gawain and Percival and Tristan and the other knights of the Round Table gave me pride, until I learned that these exploits weren't historical, but legendary. Years later, with my mother's help, I would scour the library in the hopes of separating the mythical from the factual. I found out that Stirling Castle in Scotland had been renamed Snowdon Castle in honor of this Arthurian victory as part of an attempt by the Scots to shore up their claim to the throne of England. Reality, I learned, is nearly always messier and less flattering than we might want it to be, but also in some strange way, often richer than the myths. By the time I uncovered the truth about Arthur, I had long been obsessed with a new and different type of story, or a new and different type of storytelling. On Christmas 1989, a Nintendo appeared in the house. I took to that two-tone gray console so completely that my alarmed mother imposed a rule. I could only rent a new game when I finished reading a book. Games were expensive, and having already mastered the ones that had come with the console, a single cartridge combining Super Mario Brothers and Duck Hunt, I was eager for other challenges. The only snag was that at 6 years old, I couldn't read as fast as I could complete a game. It was time for another of my neophyte hacks. I started coming home from the library with shorter books and books with lots of pictures. There were visual encyclopedias of inventions with crazy drawings of velocipedes and blimps, and comic books that I realized only later were abridged for-kids versions of Jules Verne and H.G. Wells. It was the NES, the janky but genius 8-bit Nintendo Entertainment System, that was my real education. From The Legend of Zelda, I learned that the world exists to be explored. From Mega Man, I learned that my enemies have much to teach. And from Duck Hunt, well, Duck Hunt taught me that even if someone laughs at your failures, it doesn't mean you get to shoot them in the face. Ultimately, though, it was Super Mario Brothers that taught me what remains perhaps the most important lesson of my life. I am being perfectly sincere. I am asking you to consider this seriously. Super Mario Brothers, the 1.0 edition, is perhaps the all-time masterpiece of side-scrolling games. When the game begins, Mario is standing all the way to the left of the legendary opening screen, and he can only go in one direction. He can only move to the right, as new scenery and enemies scroll in from that side. He progresses through 8 worlds of 4 levels each, all of them governed by time constraints, until he reaches the evil Bowser and frees the captive Princess Toadstool. Throughout all 32 levels, Mario exists in front of what in gaming parlance is called an invisible wall, which doesn't allow him to go backward. There is no turning back, only going forward. For Mario and Luigi, for me, and for you, life only scrolls in one direction, which is the direction of time. And no matter how far we might manage to go, that invisible wall will always be just behind us, cutting us off from the past, compelling us on into the unknown. A small kid growing up in small-town North Carolina in the 1980s has to get a sense of mortality from somewhere. So why not from two Italian immigrant plumber brothers with an appetite for sewer mushrooms? One day, my much-used Super Mario Brothers cartridge wasn't loading, no matter how much I blew into it. That's what you had to do back then, or what we thought you had to do. You had to blow into the open mouth of the cartridge to clear it of the dust, debris, and pet hair that tended to accumulate there. But no matter how much I blew, both into the cartridge and into the cartridge slot of the console itself, the TV screen was full of blotches and waves, which were not reassuring in the least. In retrospect, the Nintendo was probably just suffering from a faulty pin connection, but given that my 7-year-old self didn't even know what a pin connection was, I was frustrated and desperate. Worst of all, my father had only just left on a Coast Guard trip and wouldn't be back to help me fix it for 2 weeks. I knew of no Mario-style time-warping tricks or pipes to dive into that would make those weeks pass quicker, so I resolved to fix the thing myself. If I succeeded, I knew my father would be impressed. I went out to the garage to find his gray metal toolbox. I decided that to figure out what was wrong with the thing, first I had to take it apart. Basically, I was just copying, or trying to copy, the same motions that my father went through whenever he sat at the kitchen table repairing the house's VCR or cassette deck, the two household machines that, to my eye, the Nintendo console most closely resembled. It took me about an hour to dismantle the console, with my uncoordinated and very small hands trying to twist a flat screwdriver into Phillips head screws, but eventually I succeeded. The console's exterior was a dull monochrome gray, but the interior was a welter of colors. It seemed like there was an entire rainbow of wires and glints of silver and gold jutting out of the green as grass circuit board. I tightened a few things here, loosened a few things there, more or less at random, and blew on every part. After that, I wiped them all down with a paper towel. Then I had to blow on the circuit board again to remove the bits of paper towel that had gotten stuck to what I now know were the pins. Once I'd finished my cleaning and repairs, it was time for reassembly. Our golden lab treasure might have swallowed one of the tiny screws, or maybe it just got lost in the carpet or under the couch. And I must not have put all the components back in the same way I'd found them, because they barely fit into the console's shell. The shell's lid kept popping off, so I found myself squeezing the components down the way you try to shut an overstuffed suitcase. Finally, the lid snapped into place, but only on one side. The other side bulged up, and snapping that side into place only caused the first side to bulge. I went back and forth like that for a while, until I finally gave up and plugged the unit in again. I pressed the power button, and nothing. I pressed the reset button, and nothing. Those were the only two buttons on the console. Before my repairs, the light next to the buttons had always glowed molten red. But now even that was dead. The console just sat there, lopsided and useless. And I felt a surge of guilt and dread. My father, when he came home from his Coast Guard trip, wasn't going to be proud of me. He was going to jump on my head like a Goomba. But it wasn't his anger I feared, so much as his disappointment. To his peers, my father was a master electronic systems engineer who specialized in avionics. To me, he was a household mad scientist who'd try to fix everything himself, electrical outlets, dishwashers, hot water heaters, and AC units. I'd work as his helper whenever he'd let me, and in the process, I'd come to know both the physical pleasures of manual work and the intellectual pleasures of basic mechanics, along with the fundamental principles of electronics, the differences between voltage and current, between power and resistance. Every job we undertook together would end either in a successful act of repair or a curse, as my father would fling the unsalvageable piece of equipment across the room and into the cardboard box of things that can't be unbroken. I never judged him for these failures. I was always too impressed by the fact that he had dared to hazard an attempt. When he returned home and found out what I'd done to the NES, he wasn't angry.
much to my surprise. He wasn't exactly pleased either, but he was patient. He explained that understanding why and how things had gone wrong was every bit as important as understanding what component had failed. Figuring out the why and how would let you prevent the same malfunction from happening again in the future. He pointed to each of the console's parts in turn, explaining not just what it was, but what it did, and how it interacted with all the other parts to contribute to the correct working of the mechanism. Only by analyzing a mechanism in its individual parts were you able to determine whether its design was the most efficient to achieve its task. If it was the most efficient, just malfunctioning, then you fixed it. But if not, then you made modifications to improve the mechanism. This was the only proper protocol for repair jobs, according to my father, and nothing about it was optional. In fact, this was the fundamental responsibility you had to technology. Like all my father's lessons, this one had broad applications beyond our immediate task. Ultimately, it was a lesson in the principle of self-reliance, which my father insisted that America had forgotten sometime between his own childhood and mine. Ours was now a country in which the cost of replacing a broken machine with a newer model was typically lower than the cost of having it fixed by an expert, which itself was typically lower than the cost of sourcing the parts and figuring out how to fix it yourself. This fact alone virtually guaranteed technological tyranny, which was perpetuated not by the technology itself, but by the ignorance of everyone who used it daily and yet failed to understand it. To refuse to inform yourself about the basic operation and maintenance of the equipment you depended on was to passively accept that tyranny and agree to its terms. When your equipment works, you'll work. But when your equipment breaks down, you'll break down too. Your possessions would possess you. It turned out that I had probably just broken a solder joint, but to find out exactly which one, my father wanted to use special test equipment that he had access to at his laboratory at the Coast Guard base. I suppose he could have brought the test equipment home with him, but for some reason he brought me to work instead. I think he just wanted to show me his lab. He decided I was ready. I wasn't. I'd never been anywhere so impressive, not even the library, not even the Radio Shack at the Lynnhaven Mall. What I remember most are the screens. The lab itself was dim and empty, the standard issue beige and white of government construction. But even before my father hit the lights, I couldn't help but be transfixed by the pulsating glow of electric green. Why does this place have so many TVs? Was my first thought, quickly followed up by, and why are they all tuned to the same channel? My father explained that these weren't TVs, but computers. And though I'd heard the word before, I didn't know what it meant. I think I initially assumed that the screens, the monitors, were the computers themselves. He went on to show them to me, one by one, and tried to explain what they did. This one processed radar signals, and that one relayed radio transmissions, and yet another one simulated the electronic system on an aircraft. I won't pretend that I understood even half of it. These computers were more advanced than nearly everything in use at that time in the private sector, far ahead of almost anything I had ever imagined. Sure, their processing units took a full 5 minutes to boot, their displays only showed one color, and they had no speakers for sound effects or music. But those limitations only marked them as serious. My father plopped me down in a chair, raising it until I could just about reach the desk and the rectangular hunk of plastic that was on it. For the first time in my life, I found myself in front of a keyboard. My father had never let me type on his Commodore 64, and my screen time had been restricted to video game consoles with their purpose-built controllers. But these computers were professional, general-purpose machines, not gaming devices, and I didn't understand how to make them work. There was no controller, no joystick, no gun. The only interface was that flat hunk of plastic set with rows of keys printed with letters and numbers. The letters were even arranged in a different order than the one that I'd been taught at school. The first letter was not A, but Q, followed by W, E, R, T, and Y. At least the numbers were in the same order in which I'd learned them. My father told me that every key on the keyboard had a purpose, every letter, every number, and that their combinations had purposes too. And just like with the buttons on a controller or joystick, if you could figure out the right combinations, you could work miracles. To demonstrate, he reached over me, typed a command, and pressed the Enter key. Something popped up on the screen that I now know is called a text editor. Then he grabbed a post-it note and a pen and scribbled out some letters and numbers and told me to type them up exactly while he went off to repair the broken Nintendo. The moment he was gone, I began reproducing his scribbles on screen by pecking away at the keys. A left-handed kid raised to be a righty, I immediately found this to be the most natural method of writing I'd ever encountered. 10. Input, quote, what is your name, question mark, close quote, semicolon, name, dollar sign. 20. Print, quote, hello, comma, close quote, plus name, dollar sign, plus, quote, exclamation point, close quote. It may sound easy to you, but you're not a young child. I was. I was a young child with chubby, stubby fingers, who didn't even know what quotation marks were, let alone that I had to hold down the shift key in order to type them. After a whole lot of trial and a whole lot of error, I finally succeeded in finishing the file. I pressed enter, and in a flash, the computer was asking me a question. What is your name? I was fascinated. The note didn't say what I was supposed to do next, so I decided to answer and pressed my new friend enter once more. Suddenly, out of nowhere, hello, Eddie, wrote itself on screen in a radioactive green that floated atop the blackness. This was my introduction to programming and to computing in general, a lesson in the fact that these machines do what they do because somebody tells them to, in a very special, very careful way. And that somebody can even be 7 years old. Almost immediately, I grasped the limitations of gaming systems. They were stifling in comparison to computer systems. Nintendo, Atari, Sega, they all confined you to levels and worlds that you could advance through, even defeat, but never change. The repaired Nintendo console went back to the den where my father and I competed in two-player Mario Kart, Double Dragon, and Street Fighter. By that point, I was significantly better than him at all those games, the first pursuit in which I proved more adept than my father. But every so often, I'd let him beat me. I didn't want him to think that I wasn't grateful. I'm not a natural programmer, and I've never considered myself any good at it. But I did, over the next decade or so, become good enough to be dangerous. To this day, I still find the process magical. Typing in the commands in all these strange languages that the processor then translates into an experience that's available not just to me, but to everyone. I was fascinated by the thought that one individual programmer could code something universal, something bound by no laws or rules or regulations except those essentially reducible to cause and effect. There was an utterly logical relationship between my input and the output. If my input was flawed, the output was flawed. If my input was flawless, the computer's output was too. I'd never before experienced anything so consistent and fair, so unequivocally unbiased. A computer would wait forever to receive my command, but would process it the very moment I hit enter, no questions asked. No teacher had ever been so patient, yet so responsive. Nowhere else, certainly not at school, and not even at home, had I ever felt so in control that a perfectly written set of commands would perfectly execute the same operation time and again would come to seem to me, as it did to so many smart, tech-inclined children of the millennium, the one stable, saving truth of our generation.